Michael Casey, let's talk movies. We're going to be talking about the Toronto International Film Festival. But first, let's talk about Dear Evan Hansen, now out in theaters.
Yeah, we like to start every week with a new release, a big one. And this week, it's Dear Evan Hansen, the screen adaptation of the 2017 Tony Award-winning musical stage show from Stephen Levinson. And Levinson's here. He writes the screenplay, and Stephen Chbosky directs. But this isn't actually the first time that Dear Evan Hansen has been transferred to a different medium, because in 2018, the show was adapted into a YA novel. And I haven't seen the stage show or read the book, so I can't speak to the success of the movie as an adaptation of the show or of a book, but I can speak to the success of Dear Evan Hansen as a movie, and it's not. I think that this is a work that is just simultaneously saccharine and cynical and just makes a lot of really questionable choices. But before we get into that, we've got to set the stage here. Our protagonist is Evan Hansen. He is a high school student suffering from social anxiety, which is pretty typical for most teenagers, but Evan's a little more so. His therapist has the suggestion that every day Evan should write himself a letter as a kind of motivational pep talk. And that's where we get the title, Dear Evan Hansen. And that's where the movie's engine really kind of kicks in, because Evan's having a hard day, so hard that he can't even lie to himself in this letter that's like, this could be a good day and this here's why. So he writes a completely different letter, and it suspiciously sounds like a suicide note. It's very down, and it's addressed Dear Evan Hansen, and it's signed me, which is where we get some confusion coming on later on. Evan is going to go print the letter at the school library. Why he wants to print it out, I'm not 100% sure. But while he's there, he gets into an argument with another lonely student by the name of Connor Murphy. And through some happenstance, Connor ends up with a letter in his hand. He reads the letter and makes this pretty wild jump to conclusion that the letter's about him in some capacity, and runs off with the letter. This leaves Evan just totally embarrassed and humiliated, because he fears that Connor is going to use it as some form of blackmail or worse. And he does, but not in any conventional manner, because the next time Evan sees the letter, it's when Connor's parents hand it back to him because Connor is dead. And they think that the Dear Evan Hansen letter that was on Connor's person was his suicide note to Evan. And that's probably more than enough plot than you need to kind of get into this movie. I mean, this script is just thick with twists and turns and way more characters than the movie really has any time for. And it's stitched together through a variety of songs. This is a musical. The songs are written by Benj Pasek and Justin Paul. And frankly, they're pretty catchy tunes. It's just that they really run like this hither and yon and never really settle on any one particular thing throughout the movie. And like, this is a story about like anxiety and depression and mental health and suicide and all of that. But the movie never really gets at anything other than just kind of basic observation that people have problems, which it takes the movie from this kind of bland realm, which is really the first hour and a half of this film, into something that starts off to becoming just infuriating, which is where I ended up on this movie. Because the whole thing, the whole project here is like designed to bring awareness to mental health issues, but the movie just doesn't want to explore anything outside of Evan's social awkwardness and like self-serving desires. And that just becomes more and more tone deaf as certain characters crop up throughout the movie. Let's take, for instance, Evan's mom, played by Julianna Moore. She really gets short shrift in this movie, and she is a hardworking single mother who's got her own baggage here, that she gets one song and that is pretty much it. She's just window dressing on this story, as is Alana, who is the high school class president. And she's played very well by Amanda Sternberg. And I think her character might be the most interesting in the movie, and a potential relationship between her and Evan might also be one of the most interesting things in the movie. But Evan has no interest in her as a romantic interest, and the movie has no interest in her and her troubles. So we just kind of stick with Evan Hansen. We try to resolve this issue with Connor, which again, this movie, he gives him a weird third act reprisal that recast a lot of what we learned from, or what we thought of in the first act, kind of cast it in this troubling pall. And it's just, it doesn't gel. I should say here that Connor is played by Colton Ryan. And Evan Hansen is played by Ben Platt, who won the Tony for his performance as Evan Hansen on the stage back in 2017. And Platt can sing the hell out of these songs, but he's 27 and he looks all of 27. And Stephen Chbosky really likes to use close-ups, especially when he's singing. And that doesn't really do the movie any favors, especially when he has scenes with other high school characters, and especially since the actresses, who aren't that much younger than Platt, they just present a lot younger. This movie has a lot of problems, which is a shame, because I heard some great things about the show. Clearly the material has struck a chord with audiences over these last 5 or 6 years. It just, none of that magic comes across in the movie. But look, if none of that matters to you and you still want to go out and see a big studio musical in the theaters, then you're in luck, because Dear Evan Hansen is out now and it's playing just about everywhere.
Well, the Toronto International Film Festival has just wrapped up. It was virtual again this year, and you were there for all of it. What are some of the takeaways that you got?
Well, I had a weird gravitation to a bunch of movies that were either conceived or written pre-pandemic, but seemed to have this weird addressing of where we're at now. One I definitely want to talk about, but very cagily so, because I don't want to spoil anything about it. And I don't know exactly when it's going to come out, but based off who's in the movie, I can tell you that it's going to see some sort of release. And that's Silent Night. It's an English black comedy from writer-director Camille Griffin. She is the mother of Roman Griffin. He's the little kid from Jojo Rabbit. And his parents are played by Keira Knightley and Matthew Good. So just based off of that pedigree, you can tell that this is going to be a movie that comes out. This is a movie that deals with a very finite moment in human history. And it deals with it in humor, and it deals with it in conversation and conflict. Now, why that's interesting is because there's a conversation that happens between the characters. It's one of the crux conversations that the movie revolves around, about listening to experts. And what happens when the expert is wrong? And do you believe the expert? Now, when Camille Griffin wrote this, it was probably 2017, 2018. When they made this film, they made it right as London was locking down at 2020. But that doesn't matter, because everyone who's going to see it is going to see it post-COVID, post-vaccination, and they're going to read these conversations and where this movie ends up as very specific to that. And that, I think that is what's really interesting about these movies, is that they're imbued with the DNA of their time, both of when they were made them, because they are responding to the world in which they are made, but the audiences always respond to them in the world in which they watch them. So when we watch movies that were made in the 50s, they feel like they're from the 50s, but we connect with them, not from people watching in the 50s, but from people watching in the 2021. And so there's a lot of movies that are going to come out that are just on the very edge of going into the pandemic that somehow address it in this weird, weird way. A couple of other ones I want to highlight. Playing the same kind of sandbox as Silent Night, which is this not post-apocalyptic look at world, but almost this look at a world that is at odds with itself, as if like it is no longer tenable to continue going the way we are going. One of them is called Where is Anne Frank? This is the new animated drama from Ari Folman. And this one is set in near future Holland, at the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam. And if you've never been to the Anne Frank House, this is the secret annex where Frank and the Van Pels head out from the Nazis for a couple of years before they were captured and sent to the camps. It has been turned into a museum. And actually everything around this house now bears the name of Anne Frank. There's Anne Frank Bridges, there's Anne Frank Canal, there's the Anne Frank School with the Anne Frank Library and the Anne Frank Theater. And like, it is this marker post for probably the world's most famous refugee. And people line up by the thousands to go to see the Anne Frank House. And as they line the street of West Market 20 to get into the Anne Frank House, they turn a blind eye to all of the tents and cardboard boxes and trash cans in which refugees from African countries are sleeping, because they're trying to pretend that that's not there. They even get pushed into certain sections of the city because they don't want to devalue property. They don't want to see the problem. And they're actually, what's interesting is that the Dutch are not hostile at any point to the refugees. It's just that they're apathetic. It almost seems worse the way that Folman kind of constructs this story. And he is full-blown surface level connecting A to A here, that so many people will spend so much time looking about this one historical refugee and thinking about what it takes to survive in that world, and completely ignore that the problem still exists to this day, and that someone just needs to stand up and take part of this. This also interestingly intersected with another movie I saw from Lebanon. It's called Costa Brava Lebanon, from filmmaker Muna Aki. This is her first film. And this story is also set in the near future. And in the near future, Beirut is plagued with social unrest and toxic pollution and garbage upon just piles of trash. And so the government decides that what they're going to do is they're going to open up a brand new green landfill that's sustainable up in the hills, outside of Beirut, and they're going to push all the trash up there. And of course, they push it into the last green space in Lebanon, right next to the Badri family, who have this beautiful bucolic kind of compound that they live in, this like almost secluded harmony sort of thing. And now they're right next to a land dump. There's backhoes, shovels, and digging and blasting and trash everywhere, just more plastic bags piled on top of each other than can. It's a big problem for them, but it is obviously not a big problem for the people of Beirut, because is that, again, we're back to out of sight, out of mind. Like, we have these problems, but we just choose not to acknowledge them. It happens in Silent Night. It happens in a bunch of other movies. I saw The Pink Cloud is another one where it's like, I cannot believe that this is a movie that speaks so clearly to today, even though it was conceived and made well before. There's some really interesting films that were at TIFF that reminded me of this one study that goes back to like the 60s. Krasauer was a philosopher who came up with this idea of, it's called From Caligari to Hitler. And he looked at the Weimar cinema of Germany pre the rise of the Nazi power, and found so many thematic strands in the films that were being made at that time that then became manifest politically in the Nazi party, and how that is a very popular medium, that film kind of expresses this collective subconsciousness, that you can really see the problems that we're dealing with in movies much more bluntly than when you do if in some other medias, whether it's music or literature or theater or stuff. I was floored. I saw so many good things there. There's a lot of great stuff coming out, and as it does, I'll definitely I'll keep you up to date on that. And one last thing, I would be remiss if we did not acknowledge the passing of a real titan of cinema this past week, Melvin Van Peebles, who many credit with kicking off the blaxploitation cycle of the 1970s. He died this past Tuesday at the age of 89. And if the name Melvin Van Peebles doesn't ring a bell, then this is the perfect time to familiarize yourself with his work, because these films, they're just a real hand grenade that was lobbied at the industry, particularly his 1971 breakthrough hit, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. That is five S's in Badass, which is up there with like Citizen Kane and Breathless and Sex, Lies, and Videotape as a movie that really broke the mold. And the movie is, Sweetback is a total trip. And if you have any interest in making movies someday, especially if you want to make independent movies your way with, you know, you don't want the man on your back, or if you just really like hearing about how freaking hard it is to make a movie, then I also recommend the movie Badass, which is based off of Van Peebles' diaries he kept while making Sweet Sweetback. Now, Badass was made in 2003. It stars and is directed by Melvin's son, Mario Van Peebles, who is a director in his own right. He made New Jack City and Posse, which is this really great underappreciated Black Western. And both Sweet Sweetback and Badass, as well as six other movies and like a handful of shorts and a bunch of interviews, are being put together in a gorgeous box set from Criterion, which amazingly comes out next Tuesday. So like the timing is perfect. It's five discs. It's well worth the price. If you want to know more about Van Peebles, if you want to know more about the set, then go ahead and look forward to next week's Boulder Weekly, because I'm going to have time for a full appreciation of Van Peebles' life and work, and he is worth every penny.
Well, Michael Casey, for more information about you, about your reviews, where can people go?
Well, like I said, go to Boulder Weekly. You can go to Boulder Weekly online worldwide at boulderweekly.com. If you live in the county, you can pick up the paper. It is new every Thursday and free wherever you find it. You can also go to michaeljcinema.com, where you're going to find lots of reviews, much more in depth when we talk about like Telluride and Toronto movies. It's all going to be there at michaeljcinema.com.